This is now talk 7 in the series on how to forgive other people. And we're now going to look at the Matthew chapter 18 procedure in some closer detail. And let me look now at some very bad experiences that I've had in trying to put that procedure into practice in dealing with disputes within the church. So, a wronged Christian who believes himself to be wronged might seek to carry out Jesus's command in Matthew 18, but the reality of it is that in the modern church, the way it is, he will not be likely to get very far. The overwhelming likelihood is that he'll get nowhere, because the structure of most churches will not allow anyone to do what Jesus said. And even if someone tries it, he'll be thwarted by the system itself and by the leaders and by the setup and by the traditions and expectations and the whole way that church is organized. And I speak from personal experience of this. I've tried to put it into practice. And let me just speak of an example of this. Some years ago, I went to see a man that I give the name Rick. I speak of him in my book 6 as well. And he was the leader of a church that I was then part of. Now, I was actually the chairman of the trustees of that church, and he was the main full-time paid leader. And I had become increasingly concerned about the way that Rick was operating. He was getting a well-deserved reputation within the town for being worldly, carnal, and dishonest, and that was my concern. But I got absolutely nowhere in trying to raise those issues with him. And the entire system within the leadership of the church obstructed me instead of helping me, and as I tried to implement Matthew 18. So my own experience on that occasion of attempting each of the stages of Matthew 18 was as follows. So stage one, I went to speak to Rick, the leader, privately, one-to-one, and told him my concerns, and I did it politely. Graciously, I think, but he rejected what I had to say to him, even though everything I said was completely true and fully documented. And instead of facing the real issues, Rick's response was to attack me for raising those issues. And he then also set about telling lies about me within the church in order to prevent me from being able to take matters any further. So what he was doing, it's the age-old trick, he was seeking to get in first to stop me from being listened to or believed by other people. So he told lies in order to undermine me in advance so that when I later, if I was later to speak to others, I wouldn't be believed. And he did it all very craftily. That was partly because he was so dishonest, but also because he had had such a lot of practice at handling complaints and challenges of this type. Because although I didn't know it at the time, he had already had substantial previous experience at dealing with others who had tried to talk to him and tried to challenge him about his behaviour and his standards and so on. So I got nowhere with stage one. So stage two, when I went to that stage, I saw Rick again, this time with two witnesses present, but he lied brazenly in front of them about what was happening. And amazingly, when the two witnesses left the room, these were two senior figures from the church, when he left, Rick then openly admitted to me that he'd been lying to them about what had happened. So when I asked him why he'd lied to them, he just shrugged his shoulders and said, well, I had to defend myself. And that was the way he dealt with it. That was his attitude towards telling lies. So therefore, the two witnesses were of no use at all. They were too soft, they were too weak. They were only concerned, really, with trying to smooth things over, not to deal with things. And they were not sufficiently robust or vigorous. It needed someone strong in that situation. But they weren't strong, and they weren't robust, and they weren't motivated. And Rick knew that very well. If they had been strong and robust and motivated, he would never have allowed them to be the witnesses in that meeting. So they didn't actually want to tackle anything. They were afraid that doing so would create some kind of unpleasantness or controversy for themselves and for the church, and they just weren't willing to. So to all intents and purposes, they may as well not have been there at all, because they served no useful purpose whatsoever. So stage two, again, was a complete failure, achieved nothing whatsoever. Now, as for stage three, I wasn't even permitted to implement that, to go to stage three and to bring it to the whole church. That's what the next stage is, but it just wasn't possible. There were over about 200 people in that church, but the leadership team didn't want me to go to the whole church, despite it being commanded in Matthew 18. And I think I can fully understand why they didn't. It's because some of those leaders themselves were behaving very carnally and dishonestly, and they didn't therefore want any of these facts about the leader or about themselves to come out openly into the church. Because if such information as that had been allowed to come out to the wider membership, a lot of people who already had the beginnings of a concern or just a niggling little doubt or anxiety about the leadership of the church would have been able to see the wider picture. And that is what the leaders didn't want people to see. Because if a person just has a little concern about some incident that they know about, but they don't know anything else, they don't know the wider picture, it's much harder for that person to have confidence that they're seeing things correctly. But if the membership had been able to see what my concerns were and what the other things that were happening were, then those members would have joined up the dots together, as you might say, and they'd have realised that there was actually a consistent pattern of behaviour on Rick's part, and also of covering things up. So the leadership as a whole were simply not willing to take the risk of any of that happening, and they didn't want any of this brought to the wider church. So I just followed the stages of Matthew 18, and I tried stages 1 and 2, going one-to-one to Rick, going back to Rick with witnesses, but that was as far as I got, and I couldn't go any further into stage 3 or 4. Now, I was by no means the first person to tackle Rick. There had been several people before me with similar concerns, and many of those had already left the church quietly in the past without any of the other members getting to know why they had left or the matters which they had raised before leaving, because just as in my case, none of it was allowed to go to the wider membership. So the stage 3 process of Matthew 18 never happened in my case or in any of these other cases, and that's why I didn't know about them. I didn't know there had been people before me trying to challenge Rick or raise issues with him. I didn't know. I thought I was the first one. I thought I was the only one. If I had known there were several others, it would have affected the way I handled things. I would have gone to see them. I would have had, I think, a greater level of certainty about the rightness of what I was saying if I'd known all that, but I didn't know all that. And the reason I didn't know all that is because they had made sure that nobody did know all that. They made sure that the wider membership never got to know about people's concerns. So when those people left on all those various occasions, false explanations were given for their departure by Rick and by the other leaders. And those explanations, I can say, always seemed to make sense. So when people left, there was just excuses were made, reasons were given. We didn't question it. No one questioned it. And Rick and the other leaders found a way every time to put the blame on the people who had left. And the membership of the church always believed him and believed what they were said, what they were told. And but also the leaders as a whole used this device as well. They made earnest sounding pleas to the remaining members not to gossip or not to believe anything that was said about an elder and so on. All of which sounds terribly spiritual and terribly mature. But it was all said with complete insincerity, and the objective was simply to stop people asking questions, to stop information getting around, and it worked. It worked remarkably well for them. and those deliberate lies and tactics prevented the wider membership from getting to hear about or from getting to believe what was said, or even from speaking to people who had concerns or who tried to express concerns. Now, I didn't realise any of that till later, until after my own departure from the church. And because when my turn came to tackle Rick, I thought I was the first and the only one ever to have done so. And so, I think, did everyone else who had tackled him. We were all dealt with on our own. There was no knowledge on any of our part that we were part of a wider pattern. Okay, well, what about stage four? Now, the leaders had already skipped stage three, and they completely avoided stage four as well. Rick himself remained a member of the church, and he even continued as the leader of the church, and nothing at all was done to confront him or to expose him. And instead of the elders discussing his misconduct with the whole membership of the church and him being removed from his position or removed from the church, all that happened was that Rick himself spoke to two leaders of separate churches in the town, both of whom were friends of his, and he arranged for them to see me. So this was being done instead of stages 3 and 4 of the Matthew 18 procedure. So he arranged for them to see me to discuss my concerns, or rather, to be more accurate, just to pacify me and to get me to be quiet. And just like the two witnesses who'd come from within the church at stage 2 of the Matthew 18 procedure, these two men who came in from outside, they were supposed to be witnesses and mediators and so on, but they really, as before, they had no wish at all to genuinely deal with anything. They were not willing to do anything robust or decisive which might cause them to get their own hands dirty or which might cause any unpleasantness or controversy of any kind. And in particular, they were not willing at all to confront Rick about any of his behaviour. All they wanted to do was to smooth things over and, as they put it, to resolve matters amicably. Now, that's fine. Resolving matters amicably is fine if things can be properly resolved amicably. But it's not fine if that's being done instead of dealing with things. Because what they really meant by that phrase was they just wanted to sweep it all under the carpet, stop things from being spoken about any longer, and just to brush it away, fob everything off. And so there was just no appetite at all to tackle the real issues, no willingness to do so. In fact, they were absolutely determined not to tackle anything, and also to prevent me from tackling anything. Now, I suppose in their own way, these two external church leaders from two different churches, they were kindly people. I knew one of them very well. I knew the other one less well. And to a certain extent, I think they meant to do some good. They thought they were doing some good, albeit in a weak and misguided sort of way. But they were never going to be willing to grasp any kind of nettle or tackle anything head on. Their only aim was to avoid tackling things and to calm things down. And above all, they wanted to protect the interests and the career of Rick, the leader, their fellow leader, no matter what he'd done. And it was really more like trade unionism, where a couple of shop stewards are protecting a fellow shop steward, regardless of whether he's right or wrong. And in fact, at one stage in one of the meetings we had, I actually put that point to one of these two outside leaders. I said that they were acting like a trade union for leaders rather than as a church. And he just smiled nervously and effectively agreed with me by shrugging as if to say, what else can we do? We've got to stick together. And he essentially and effectively just admitted and accepted my point. Not explicitly in words, but just by his response. You could see it written on his face and in his reaction. He had nothing to contend with me about. He couldn't argue. He had no way of denying the fact that they were just brushing it all under the carpet. Now, I was so naive at that time that all of this deception and evasion and scheming, it was shocking to me. I was amazed and shocked by it. I could hardly bring myself to believe that leaders in the church and in other churches could act so wrongly and so dishonestly and in such a cowardly way and without any apparent concern about what Jesus thought of them. And that it seemed to me none of them had any fear of God and no anxiety about facing him in judgment and no wish to do what Jesus said we should do in Matthew chapter 18. And neither did they want to cooperate with me to enable me to do what Jesus said. Now, if I hadn't been such an assertive and professionally qualified person with police experience and management experience and legal experience and so on, I would never have got past stage one. In fact, it was exceptional to get as far as I did get. Nobody before me had ever got that far. Others had tried to tackle Rick before, but they'd all achieved nothing. They'd got even less far than I did. Now, in the end, at the end of my confrontation with Rick, it all had a very sad ending. Rick wasn't able to keep up appearances much longer after his clash with me, and within a year or so, he had totally given up church leadership. He'd left his wife, he'd found another woman, and he left the town, and he gave up ministry altogether. And also, on top of that, one of the other members of the senior leadership team, I'll give him the name Peter, I speak about him in book 6, he also left his wife. Now, during the procedures I'd gone through to try to tackle Rick, Peter in particular had been particularly obstructive to me, and hostile, and aggressive. He'd very stridently got in my way and tried to prevent me asking questions, prevent me getting anywhere. He didn't want me tackling issues about Rick's carnal behaviour and approach. He really didn't want anything dealt with. And I couldn't entirely understand at the time why Peter was so obstructive towards me, but it also came out later that Peter himself, and that's not his name, that's the name I'm giving him, had been having an affair for quite a long time, even while he was on the senior leadership team. And it then made sense to me as to why Peter had shouted me down when I'd tried to raise the issue of Rick's, the senior leader's, carnal lifestyle. It was all too close to home for him, I think. And in particular, he didn't want to allow this Matthew 18 procedure to lead to any questions being asked about himself. So, all the attempts that various leaders within that church had made over a number of years to squash discontent, to squash questioning, to prevent any kind of inquiry or accountability, it all achieved nothing for them. They tried to cover things up, but nothing good came of it. All they ever did was to cause more damage, and even more people got hurt. And neither I nor any of my predecessors got anywhere with the Matthew 18 procedure in that church. Nothing was achieved. We didn't get anywhere. So it would be good if I could say that my experience and that of those others in that church, our experience of failing with Matthew 18 was exceptional. I wish we could say it was exceptional and that this kind of thing doesn't happen elsewhere or to anybody else. But sadly, I can't say that. It's actually pretty much the norm. So what happened in our case was totally typical. That's what's happening all over the place whenever anyone tries to bring any kind of inquiry through Matthew 18. And I've since come to learn that from many other people who've had similar experiences all over the country. It's not just a local issue affecting our local church at that time. And so, but also, I've come across it myself in other places. And in fact, several years later, I left another church in another town when I'd moved town, as a result of another leader's behaviour. And I left that church because it came to light that the leader's character was also seriously flawed and defective. His conduct was controlling, he was manipulative, he was deceptive, he was just really devious. And so when I realised that that's what he was, we just decided to get out. But this time, I didn't even attempt to implement the Matthew 18 procedure. I took no steps to do anything about it, other than to telephone the deputy leader of the church to say that we were leaving. And I also wrote a private letter to the leader, which I copied to the deputy leader, explaining my concerns. But again, it got me absolutely nowhere. The leader just sent back a brazen, evasive reply, quite cocky, ignoring all the points I raised. And the deputy leader of that church, again, he did nothing whatsoever to assist. In fact, he just got annoyed with me for being unhelpful, as he put it, and to quote him, for writing a critical letter. That's how he put it. Even though the letter I wrote was private and was only sent to the leader and to him, I didn't send it to the whole church. And as was the case when I tackled Rick, these two, they both saw the person who was raising the concerns is the problem, not the person about whom those concerns are being raised. Now that is a very typical response. They see the person who's making the complaint as the problem, not what you're complaining about. And so on that second occasion in that other church, I largely kept out of it, and I felt I'd learned my lesson the previous time. But three other families in that other church, in the second church, they made a valiant attempt to deal with the issues, and instead of just leaving quietly, they tried to go through something akin to Matthew 18. At least they tried anyway. And again, it led, curiously, to a similar outcome as in Rick's church, because the leaders of that second church, they arranged for two men from another local church to come in, supposedly to mediate. It's exactly the same as had happened with Rick. But of course, these two men who were brought in were friends of the leader that was being complained about. They were just his buddies. And it was all remarkably similar to what had happened in my own case. And so these two men that came in, all they wanted to do was to smooth things over and to get people to be quiet. And again, there was no attempt whatsoever to genuinely address any of the character issues or behavioural problems in the life of that leader. Now, this second episode involving this other leader, who I give him the name Norris, and he's mentioned in book 6 as well, but that second episode happened some years later and in a different church and in a different town. But the techniques used, the attitudes of the leadership and the approach they adopted were all strikingly similar and familiar. And I've set out these brief facts of these two separate churches and the disputes that happened within them for two main reasons. The first is to enable me to explain the issues of forgiveness which arose out of it. That is, my own need to forgive the leaders who had wronged me, plus the other leaders around them who had obstructed me, and for their half-hearted intervention, which only served to cover things up rather than deal with things, and the way that they obstructed the Matthew 18 process rather than helping to implement it. But secondly, I'm speaking about this because it enables us to consider why it's so difficult in the modern church even to discuss, let alone to resolve, disputes within a church. Because if the church isn't operating in a biblical way, with a biblical structure, then genuine, meaningful attempts to deal with disputes between Christians in practical terms are just impossible. So the unbiblical structure and the worldly, carnal model of leadership, which has now become the norm, simply won't permit that to happen. And that obstruction that you come up against is not accidental, it's deliberate. Because allowing things to be openly discussed and dealt with within a church from the perspective of leaders is simply far too dangerous. Because way too much is at stake for them personally in terms of their careers, their salaries, their houses, their pensions, not to mention ego and pride. And therefore, leaders simply won't let it happen. Okay, well, let me go on to speak about my experiences of reaching a place of being able to forgive abusive and dishonest church leaders, because that's the wider context that we're looking at here. So after the first real battle against Rick and the leaders around Rick, both my wife and I were traumatized by it, really surprisingly so, more than I had ever expected or imagined. And I think also we were more traumatized than we even realized at the time. We didn't realize how much we'd been upset by it and how much we'd been violated by it. And that sense of violation and trauma, it lasted for at least 3 years at a high level, and probably for more at a lower level. And that emotional reaction on our part, it came from several factors that we had experienced within Rick's church and during that time of dispute at the end. Firstly, from other church members avoiding us and disapproving of us, and they did so without ever asking us any questions or checking anything with us. They simply believed everything that the leaders told them about us, without question, pretty much as we had believed what the leaders had told us about previous people who'd left the church, without question, without checking, without investigation. And secondly, the things that had upset us were being undermined and lied about by the elders in that church so as to harm our reputation and to prevent people listening to us or remaining friends with us. Thirdly, being deliberately obstructed by other leaders, not just Rick, but other leaders within our own church, so as to prevent Matthew 18 procedure from being used. And fourthly, being betrayed and abused and lied about by Rick, the senior leader, and also other leaders within our church. Fifthly, what affected us was being let down by the external leaders who were brought in from other churches in the town. Now, they had supposedly, in theory, been brought in to investigate matters and mediate, but they never had any genuine intention of actually doing so. Their real aim was just to smooth things over, not to grasp any kind of nettle, not to confront anybody, not to inquire into anything, not to tackle anything. And they saw me and my wife as dispensable. They viewed our departure from the church as preferable to allowing any kind of scandal to come to light. And therefore, they did nothing at all to defend us or our reputation. They sought only to defend Rick's career, the leader's career, and to preserve his reputation only, not ours. And sixthly, what upset us was being effectively driven out of our own local church, where we had been for 7 years, and where we'd got many genuine friendships, and we were driven out simply for having tried to address our concerns in a biblical way. And we think, and thought at the time, and still think, that those were entirely valid, well-founded concerns. Seventhly, being lied about by the senior leader, Rick. Now, all those things caused a sense of violation and trauma. It was really like being beaten up in an alleyway. You're just left stunned by it. And when this happens to you, it's very, very disorientating. It's very painful. And we took far longer to get over it than I ever expected. And it was the first real time we'd ever had a real dispute in a church. And our initial reaction was to want to speak about it at length to anybody who'd listen to us. And we try to show them how justified we were and how we'd been wronged and how, you know, everything we said was true. We weren't making it up and so on. But it did no good at all. It was a futile waste of time and energy, and people just weren't interested. So you have this desire to justify and vindicate yourself, but nobody's bothered. At any rate, they didn't want to get involved in our dispute or to rock the boat. And I think especially so after seeing what had happened to us for speaking out. And the other members of the church basically didn't seem to mind whether the leadership was corrupt or not. It didn't seem to bother them, provided they could have a quiet life. It just wasn't of any interest to them, which is surprising, remarkable, really. You'd imagine they would be very concerned about that, but they're not. And it's rather like the American people at the present, who don't care that Hillary Clinton is a crook, that she's a liar, a serial liar, that she's false, that she's devious, that she's malicious. These aren't even controversial points. They're not even something that anyone would seriously argue against. The point is that the people in America don't care that Hillary Clinton is like that. They don't care that Donald Trump is what he is. And only a few decades ago, people like that wouldn't have had a hope of being able to run for public office. But now they can, and no one cares that that's their reputation. And the same is true within the church. It doesn't seem to bother anyone. It doesn't seem to bother very many people if a leader is corrupt. It just doesn't seem to matter to people. Now, of course, the problem we face was hugely compounded by the fact that we were operating in a kind of church structure and leadership framework which was quite the opposite of what was envisaged by Jesus when he gave the command set out in Matthew 18. So all of our attempts to deal with things was unproductive and achieved nothing other than us just letting off steam. And all it resulted in for us was trauma and shock and just the disappointment of people not being interested and having no wish to help. But what I found most hurtful of all was just the willingness, the extreme willingness of so many people to believe any lie told about us without question. They never questioned any of it. Not one single person ever came to check anything with us and say, is it true about this? Is it true about that? They just believed it. And one person who we'd been very close to and I'd helped in a number of ways, he saw me in the street one day and just crossed the road and just avoided me. He just shunned me. Yet without saying a word to find out what had happened or whether it was true, he just believed what Rick told him, and that was it. We were written off. And that's all we achieved. We got nowhere further than that. So, but after having left Rick's church, what compounded the problems were that it took us, well, we just found it impossible to find any other good church to go to. Now that was partly because our own eyes had been opened. So the experience of dealing with Rick and the leaders around him had opened our eyes, and it's as if it had taken the scales off our eyes that had blinded us. And our eyes, therefore, had been opened. God had opened our eyes through this experience. So part of our problem was we therefore went from one extreme to the other. Having been absurdly naive and trusting, we then went to the other extreme and became very, very wary of other church leaders, even what you might imagine to be the better ones. But sadly, that wariness that we felt was not solely based on our imagination, far from it. In fact, on the whole, it was pretty well founded, because once God had opened our eyes to this problem of corruption and carnality and deviousness and manipulation within church leadership, the end result was that we saw falseness and ambition and pride and domination, control, manipulation, almost everywhere we went. We became able to see it very quickly. So things which had always been there, we hadn't noticed them before, but now we noticed them immediately. And our experience since then has been that those features are now widespread among, I think, most of the leadership of churches in Great Britain. I wish I could just say many instead of most, but I think it wouldn't be accurate. I think the only honest word I can use is to say most. It's most of the leadership. And that's partly due to the carnal condition of the churches and their leaders, but it's also partly due to the institutional and hierarchical nature of the church structure, which is not biblical. It's not the way that it was in the book of Acts and in the New Testament letters. So for many men today, very, very many men who are in church leadership, the role of leader has become a career rather than a ministry. And that is why so many men in church leadership today are hirelings rather than shepherds. A hireling is just someone who's doing it for a job. It's not a ministry. He's not a genuine shepherd. It's not his heart's desire to serve or protect the people. He's just doing a job for a wage. It's just a career. And that is true of a huge number of church leaders today. So all in all, what we went through in leaving Rick's church meant that we couldn't settle in any local church for some years. We had to calm down from the emotional trauma of that experience. But when the second crisis came in the church called Norris's Church, where Norris was the leader, and when we left that church, we suffered much less hurt. But that was only because while we were in Norris's church, we'd remained at a distance due to our wariness. We didn't allow Norris or any of the other leaders of that second church to really get close enough to do us any harm, or much harm. And as it turned out, that wariness, that keeping of our distance, turned out to be a wise and fully justified policy. And as I say, three other couples that we knew, they got badly hurt as they tried to tackle Norris, because they made a futile and naive attempt to tackle issues with him. But they got nowhere at all. Now, we avoided it that second time with Norris. We just left quietly, didn't attempt to deal with anything other than writing a letter. And I was pretty certain those other three couples would be unsuccessful, and that the leader, Norris, wouldn't listen to them or feel any remorse. And sadly, that proved to be exactly the case. So, as for dealing with the need for forgiveness from both of those episodes, we just had to work it all out for ourselves. We'd no one to teach us or tell us how to handle these things. We had to just learn for ourselves. There was no teaching that we could see or find or anything useful that could help us. So we really had to learn how to hand the whole dispute over to God and to seek his help. And we learned from bitter experience a number of lessons which have gone into this series of talks, and also into my book 6 on dealing with the wicked. And eventually, after quite a long time of trying to tell everybody about what happened and trying to explain ourselves and justify ourselves, we came to a place where we no longer felt the need to talk about it to people or to prove our innocence to everybody. But we also learned gradually how to pray for all the leaders concerned. We genuinely prayed for God to bless and restore and rebuild the ministries of the leaders who had told lies about us. And we also asked him to forgive them rather than judge them, and to hold nothing against them on our account. And I think it helped us to pray in those ways. And I hope it will have helped them too. I hope that God has answered and will answer our prayers for them. So, let's move on to another question. Should a Christian ever sue a fellow believer in a civil court or tribunal? That means by way of civil litigation. Now, as we saw earlier, Apostle Paul made a powerful statement about this in his first letter to the Corinthians. And on the face of it, what he says seems quite clear and conclusive. It's in 1 Corinthians 6, verses 1 to 8. Let me go through it again, because it's important. Verse 1, it says, "When one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more, then, matters pertaining to this life? So, if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud even your own brothers." That's 1 Corinthians 6, verses 1 to 8. Now, what Paul is saying there is effectively that if two genuine Christians, both of whom are brothers, that means in the sense of fellow believers, if they're in a genuine biblical church, then they shouldn't sue each other. Instead, they should follow the Matthew chapter 18 procedure, which was laid down by Jesus, as we've looked at earlier. And the point is that if a church is led in a biblical way by proper elders who are real shepherds, not hirelings, and who take their responsibilities seriously, then that approach can succeed. It can work, because real and meaningful discipline will result for the wrongdoer. And also, there will be scope for real vindication for the innocent party, and perhaps even for genuine redress for the wronged person. Now, the dispute, if it's handled properly in a biblical way, within a biblical church, by genuine believers, it'll be tackled on an increasingly open basis, until eventually it's heard by the whole local church, not just by the leaders. It's very important that it be heard by the whole local church. And then, if the wrongdoer won't repent and won't put things right, then at the fourth stage of Matthew 18, he'll be expelled from that church. Now, to a real believer in a real biblical church, that sanction would matter to him. It would create a real and meaningful incentive for him to operate honestly and properly and to resolve matters. So when Paul tells us not to sue, not to have litigation against fellow believers, I think we need to understand he means when both are real Christians and when they're members of a real biblical church, which is capable of resolving disputes. Now, the problem today, as I mentioned in the previous talk, is that virtually none of the conditions which Apostle Paul and Jesus assumed to exist within a church are actually applicable in our churches today. Most or all of the necessary features are missing or inapplicable. And so, firstly, there are many non-Christians who are long-standing members of churches, despite the fact that they're not genuinely born again, they're not regenerate. They may not necessarily be repentant, they may not even genuinely believe. And that's not just the exception, that's pretty much normal. There are vast numbers of people in churches today who are not born again. They're just churchgoers, they're just religious people. For whatever reason, they like being in churches. Maybe they like liturgy, the tradition, the culture. Maybe they just like hanging around churches. But they aren't real Christians and they aren't born again. So the first requirement is that you're dealing with a fellow believer. But if the person you're dealing with isn't a believer, well, you don't even get past first base on this one. The second point, the church as a whole are not biblical. See book 8 of mine for more detail on this. But most churches today are led by one man who's paid, he's a professional, and he views himself as belonging to a special class called the clergy, rather than those churches being led by a group of unpaid elders, which is what the Bible anticipates and assumes. And thirdly, the churches today in the main are not small groups meeting in a house or a barn or a school building or some kind of large warehouse or something like that, maybe with 20 to 70 people who know each other intimately. Most churches today meet in specially designed buildings with perhaps hundreds of people present who don't know each other well, probably don't know each other at all in many cases. Indeed, many, many people who attend churches, and even those who go regularly today, don't even know the names of a large proportion of the other people there, let alone know them intimately or know their characters. And therefore, they can't even hope to accurately assess the true nature of other people's characters in the event of some kind of dispute. Fourthly, instead of the churches today existing to preach the authentic gospel and to make genuine disciples, the reality is that most churches today, at least in the West, I'm not speaking about Africa or Asia or anywhere else, just the West, most of them exist for other purposes. And church leadership now is seen by very, very men as a career, not as a ministry. And if so, their main aim is to keep the church going, to remain firmly in control, to avoid controversy, to avoid loss of income, to avoid loss of giving, and to preserve their own salary and pension and home. Now, that may sound cynical, But I don't think it is. I think I'm being entirely realistic, and it's true far too much of the time, even for many of those men who began their ministries with high ideals. So the net effect of all this, about the way that church is now structured, the vast majority of churches, is that what Paul said in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verses 1 to 8, and also what Jesus said in Matthew 18, 15 to 17, it simply cannot operate effectively in the churches that most of us are attending today in the West. So, I mean, can you imagine going to the leader of any church you know, whether he be a priest or a vicar or a pastor of any kind, and telling him that one of the people in the church has wronged or defrauded you? He would be extremely unlikely to want to get involved. But even if somehow he did get involved, can you imagine him agreeing, if the dispute couldn't be resolved, that you should take it in the end to the whole church? Now, when and how could that ever be done? How would you take it to the whole church today? The members as a whole wouldn't be willing or able to tackle the dispute or to address it. But more importantly, the leaders of the church, in the vast majority of churches today, wouldn't be willing even to let them try to address it in any case. But that said, you wouldn't actually want them to address it, because you know, even if you contemplate it now, contemplate the possibility now of bringing some civil dispute to your church. What do you think would happen? You know in yourself it would be a shambles, and that nothing useful would be achieved by it. What would actually happen, 99% of the time, is that any issues that you're seeking to raise would just be dodged or fudged or glossed over in some way, so as to avoid confrontation and avoid the need for any decision to be made. And I'm not speaking simply from theory or what I hypothesize as likely to be the outcome. I'm saying that's been my experience of actually trying to do it. I've experienced it, and I've tried it, and I've failed in it, and I've seen others try it, and I've seen them fail in it, and I've never seen anyone succeed in it. And I've heard the same from many others. And therefore, the idea of not suing a fellow Christian, even if you can be sure that he really is a Christian and is genuinely born again, is simply not realistic, because there is no church structure to which you can go. There simply isn't. Now, Paul was speaking of a context and a setting which he knew in the first century church, and which he regularly experienced in all the churches he founded or visited. But it's not what we know today. And I would say today, sadly, that it is the opposite of what it was in Paul's day, and that the world's courts are actually more righteous than the apostate churches. I would have more confidence in obtaining a righteous judgment from some local district judge than I would from pretty much any church leader that I know. Now, that's a terrible thing to have to accept and admit, but I think it's true. I don't think I'm exaggerating. I think I'm stating the position. I think I'm understating the position. And so the position is, we simply can't operate this way today. It's just not going to work, because we don't have genuine biblical churches the vast majority of the time. And you see, when we speak of taking it to the whole church, again, that indicates why we need small churches. The whole idea was that you would take it to people who know you and the people who know each other. So they know who's telling the truth, who's not. They know the factual background. They know the characters of all the witnesses and the parties. They understand. But notice, it's the whole church that makes a decision to deal with this dispute and, if necessary, to expel a person, not just elders. It's not just a matter that should be taken to elders for them to deal with. The Matthew 18 procedure envisages ending up with the whole church. Now, that in itself indicates why we can't have these great huge churches. Can you imagine if you had a church with 1,000 people, as you often see in America, or 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 people, or 20,000 people? How are you going to take a dispute about a damaged lawnmower to a church with 5,000 people in? It's just not going to happen. And if it was done, it would be happening every 10 minutes, wouldn't it, because of all the disputes that there would be. simply not possible, not practical. And therefore, the prohibition that Apostle Paul spoke of not taking our disputes to secular courts, I think would not apply. At least it doesn't in my view, because the necessary preconditions that Paul had in mind don't apply. The people in churches, many of them are not Christians, the churches are not biblical, they're not set up in a biblical way, the structure isn't biblical, the leadership isn't biblical, the whole leadership structure is quite different from what Paul had in mind. And so I say that, I don't believe that you practically can implement that today in the modern church, and I think it's important. Some people may need to hear that because they may, it may set them free, because some people, innocent, the sincere types who want to do what the Bible says, have been harmed by being unable to deal with matters. They end up being trampled on because they wrongly believe that they are forbidden by the Bible to do anything to seek redress, because no redress can be obtained from the local church, and therefore, since they think that's the only place they can go to, there is nowhere to go to. And I remember a problem I dealt with some years ago where a man in the church, it was actually in Rick's church before everything fell apart, and there was a man in that church who was a school teacher and a worship leader, and he'd loaned money to a young Christian woman who was getting married, and it was to help her to cover the costs of her wedding, and it was a significant sum. We're talking, you know, well more than £1,000. It was quite a lot. And, well, let's call this man Samuel, and let's call the young woman Sybil. That's not their names, but let's call them that. Now, Samuel came to me long after this wedding because Sybil and her new husband were doing nothing to repay him. And he felt frustrated and he felt betrayed by her and her husband. But he also felt trapped by Apostle Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 6. And Samuel believed that that passage prevented him from doing anything to force Sybil or her husband to repay him. He felt he couldn't do anything. He couldn't sue them. He couldn't do anything. And he came to me and asked for my advice because I was a solicitor at the time, a lawyer, and also a Christian. And when I learned the facts of it, and knowing him and knowing them, my advice to him was that we could and should take a firm line with them. And I knew that we couldn't take the matter to the local church. That wasn't going to work. And therefore, I wrote a strong letter to Sybil and to her husband. And I said that if they didn't repay Samuel, then I would take on Samuel's case and I would sue them myself in the local court free of charge. And I wouldn't charge Samuel anything for doing it. And it worked. As soon as they got that letter, they paid up immediately. Samuel was paid in full, which proved that their non-payment up to that point was not due to any inability to pay. They just didn't want to pay. And they had actually relied on Samuel's sincerity and genuineness in taking 1 Corinthians 6 so seriously, and therefore not being willing to force them to repay. They thought they could just avoid paying Samuel permanently by relying on Apostle Paul's letter as the basis. That's how incredible this is. And this is people in a church, going to church each week and acting in that way. That's what I mean by the insincerity, the carnality, the dishonesty of so many people in churches today. Now, they knew what the Bible said on that point, and they were making capital out of it for themselves. They thought Apostle Paul's letter put them in the clear, such that they would never have to pay up. And I thought it was an appalling attitude and a clear sign of apostasy on their part. But happily for Samuel and unhappily for them, they miscalculated on that particular occasion because they came up against me and I was willing to do something about it, which was exceptional. That's a very unusual ending to a story, but that's what happened to them. Okay, well, that's all on that talk.